Random House Audio presents Two Fact the Fish by Artie Lang with Anthony Boza. Read for you by the Reverend Bob Levy, Gary Delabate, Jim Florentine, and me, Artie Lang. The words genius, icon, and legend are thrown around way too often these days in the world of entertainment, and rarely are they appropriate. This book is dedicated to a man who is that rare example of someone who truly embodies all three of those words. Howard Stern. Howard, this is Artie, man. Thank you for teaching me and a whole generation of comedians how to be funny. The Natural. I guess you could say that I won over my first audience at a very young age. I was still shitting myself at the time, and I was incapable of wiping my own ass or chewing real food, which, come to think of it, could have been just last week or any other time in my life. But back then I had an excuse. I didn't have teeth at all, so eating anything other than formula or strained mush from a jar wasn't even an option. Even so, my diet didn't stop me from killing them at Essex County Courthouse in November 1967. When I was born on October 11th, 1967, my dad was on trial, looking at about 10 years of hard time for harboring counterfeit money. My dad wasn't a bad guy at all, and he wasn't a crook or even a thief or a gambler. If anything, he had a real weakness for getting rich quick schemes. He was a sucker for any kind of plan that was too good to be true, and that kind of attitude is what got him into this mess. He got mixed up with the wrong crowd, which is what happens when you do what you're not supposed to do. He had no idea at the time how closely I'd follow that example. My dad grew up in Newark, New Jersey, which has never been what anyone would call an affluent city. His house was on 14th Avenue, which was a war zone then. Now it's like downtown Baghdad. You can't even walk there. Like any young man trying to get ahead, my dad made the most of his opportunities, and since he was always looking for his golden ticket, he decided it was a good idea for him and a friend of his to rob the local bookie armed with nothing but a piece of pipe. It doesn't take a criminal genius to predict that this scheme wouldn't go exactly as planned. They got there and suddenly wised up and never went through with it. But the bookie was impressed enough by their stupidity and balls that he offered them employment in his operation. I'm not sure what else they did for the guy, but my dad's main responsibility was stashing more than $200,000 in counterfeit money, which he packed into a cabinet above our fridge, not exactly burying the treasure. And that's where the FBI found it when they raided our apartment in Orange on a tip. My mom was very pregnant with me as she watched my dad being hauled off to jail. My mom worked as a secretary at the time, as she did for most of her life. Without my dad, she was barely going to scrape by, so it really wasn't looking good. Because my dad refused to snitch, the bookie got him a lawyer and took care of his legal fees. That kind of loyalty goes a long way with the neighborhood hoods. I can't imagine why. That kind of loyalty does not go over well with cops, however. Even for the first-time offenders like my dad. Let's just say that from the start, he wasn't winning himself any friends in the courtroom. So as the trial moved along, my family's future was not looking good at all. My dad was facing 10 years in prison, my mom was on the verge of having me like any day, and the jury didn't seem too sympathetic to his lawyer's portrayal of him as a guy who was in the wrong place at the wrong time. But the lawyer kept working the first-timer angle, the hard-working, good guy who made one mistake angle, and as the trial wound down, he figured my dad had a 50-50 shot at walking. And that is when I arrived. My dad's lawyer was not above using a newborn as a prop, so my birth became his new argument for an acquittal. He told my mom to bring me down to the courthouse for his closing statements and gave her specific instructions. He was going to ask the jury to let this entirely innocent man who gotten involved with bad men go free for the sake of his wife and newborn son. And at that moment, she was to stand and hold me up in the direction of the jury. It was my dad's only hope. That day, my mom tells me, she wore a very conservative dress that may have led the jury to believe she was Amish of Italian extraction, and she dressed me up in my baby suit, which was some kind of light blue jumpsuit. The lawyer laid it on thick, asking the jury to allow this first-time felon a second chance at life, Because, despite his crime and every other respect, he had everything to live for. He talked about me, my father's first son, and how I'd have no father at all if they sent him to jail for this one small misstep. Right then, the guy turned to the gallery, and my mom, who was in the front row, stood up on cue, just like they'd planned, and held me out to the courtroom. Now, I wasn't the best baby, but I wasn't the worst, and I was never what I'd call a picture-perfect little angel, like the kid on a package of Charmin. I don't know what got into me, but at that moment, I delivered. My mom stood up and extended me in the direction of the jury, and it was like a light from heaven shone on my face. My eyes lit up, I smiled, I giggled. I had that room in the palm of my little infant hand. They were mine, all right. There was no way they were going to let this little cherub spend his first decade on Earth without a father. My dad walked, no harm, no foul, and after that he straightened himself out for good. He got a job as an antenna installer, which he loved and was really good at. He did that job until he couldn't do it anymore. He was a great parent, my father. He is probably the source of whatever it is about me that anyone who has bothered to pick this book up thinks is funny. He understood my sense of humor and shared the same taste for the strange and idiotic that I do. And he definitely supported my choices, as stupid as they got, which is pretty stupid. He was right there alongside me on the path that led to where I am today. My dad passed away on February 1st, 1990, and when he did, I wasn't anywhere close to where I am now, as a comedian or a person. I was 22, I was a drunk, I was a drug addict, and professionally I wasn't what I'd call making it. I hadn't done anything at all in show business when he died. I got on Mad TV over 5 years later. I was doing stand-up, but I was far from where I wanted to be, and I wasn't what anyone might call happy. My dad always had a way of showing me the upside of things. He used to say to me all the time when I'd tell him about doing stand-up, "And you get paid to do this." He got a kick out of the fact that I actually made money to talk shit and make fun of the world, even when I wasn't making much of it. It was something he knew I'd be doing all my life, even if no one was listening. I wish he could see me now. Yeah, I get paid to do that. I get paid pretty good. Now it's my job, Pop. And it's the only job I've ever really been good at. Crawl like a man. If my father's trial was my first victory as a performer, then meeting Frankie Valli was my first run-in with one of my peers. I was about 18 months old, so Frankie and I didn't have much to talk about. But how we met is another shining example of just what kind of a nut my father was. He was amazing. A legitimately crazy Newark street kid with brazen self-confidence and a wild sense of humor that our family and almost everyone we knew found incredibly endearing. There are all types of funny, and his type got you laughing and made you shake your head at just how fucking nuts he was. But you never lost sight of the fact that he meant his jokes, gags, and teasing in an affectionate way. For those who don't know, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons were in the late 50s and 60s, what Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band is to the post-baby boomer generation. The Four Seasons was the singing group for people living in New Jersey. Frankie Valli himself grew up in North Newark in a housing project called the Stephen Crane Village, which was close to where both of my parents were from. My mother grew up just a couple of blocks away on North 7th Street, while my father lived a few miles away in South Newark. My mom and dad were born around the same year as Bob Dylan, but he was never their spokesman. The whole 60s folk scene and after it the hippie Woodstock stuff didn't really affect them at all. It wasn't just that their upbringing was so different from that of the middle-class rich kids who tuned in, turned on, and dropped out. It was that they didn't relate to the message at all. The soundtrack of my parents' young adulthood was simple, and it never wavered. Early rock and roll. And to them, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons were the coolest group in the world. To this day, my mother still doesn't like any of the boomer rock associated with her generation, aside from the Beatles, of course, which transcends all. She loves Chuck Berry, all things Motown, Bobby Darin, and all of the great 50s crooners. My father loved the same stuff, though for a brief period of time, he grew his hair kind of long and listened to the Doors. I remember him singing Roadhouse Blues and Light My Fire really loud in the truck on his way to work. But it wasn't any kind of statement other than that he liked the tunes. The Frankie Valli mindset was different. It embodied the values of the hardworking families from Newark and Union who did everything they could do to try to get a better life for their kids. It was the background music of their lives, and it spoke about their lives, so it meant a lot to them. And because of that, especially among my Italian friends, it means a lot to us. The sound wasn't current, even when I was a kid, but Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons was something that bonded every Italian kid in Union to one another. It was like an unspoken thing, probably in the same way old Italian singers like Louis Prima had meaning for our parents because of their parents. There wasn't a sense of rebelling against your parents' music when it came to Frankie Valli. That would be like going against the family. And if there's one thing all Italians know, it's that you never, ever go against the family. I don't care what anybody says. It's great music. When I was driving around with my friends, we could easily throw in a Frankie Valli tape and listen to it and really enjoy it. My buddy Mike Ciccone and I see eye to eye over this because in both of our houses growing up, Frankie and the Four Seasons was always on and our parents were always singing along. One night when we were about 19, we were out driving in Mike's Mustang convertible with the radio tuned to CBS FM, the great oldie station, when Ragdoll came on. We sat there enjoying the harmonies and Frankie's amazingly high voice until the kids who were out with us, sitting in the back seat, interrupted our good time. "What is this shit?" one of them said. "Get this shit off. Put on PLJ. My buddy Ciccone was one of those guys who really did not take shit at any time from anybody. I will never forget how he calmly lowered the volume and looked over at me, and on cue we said together, "Frankie Valli is fucking cool, man." There was no way we were going to let anyone talk shit. The others could have gotten out and walked for all we cared. Those two didn't know what they were missing. The Four Seasons easily had 30 or 40 top 10 hit records. And now there's the musical Jersey Boys, based on Frankie Valli's life story. I've seen it 3 times now, and I am far from what you'd call a patron of the theater. Really, it is the only Broadway musical I could ever see myself sitting through, because, much like The Sopranos, it has what you need to keep me interested. A good story, Jersey references like crazy, and an amazing soundtrack. Anyway, in the late 60s, my father started his own business. For years, he had hung antennas, run wires, and repaired TVs for American Radio on Route 22 in Union. Once he was married and had a child, me, he took stock and decided he needed to make some changes. He was living with his wife and a child in a small apartment on Reynolds Terrace in Orange, New Jersey. And like a guy in a Four Seasons song, my father wanted a better life. He decided to buy his own van and hustle as hard as he could to make it on his own. My dad was definitely a hard worker and an achiever, so he got that van, he worked his ass off, and once he had saved enough for a down payment, he bought us a house in the suburbs for 30 grand. Status symbols were important to my father, like having the most expensive new car that he could reasonably afford and taking the family on a big vacation every summer. For 2 weeks, usually in August, we would go down to Wildwood Crest, New Jersey. We went to Wildwood each summer until I was about 12, and I have so many good memories of those summers with my family that mean the world to me. In the summer of 69, I was a few months away from turning 2, and my sister was just a few months old. My grandmother on my mother's side, Grandma Caprio, stayed home with my sister to give my mom a bit of a break. Off we went, down the shore, and headed for the Olympic Motel. The Olympic was fine, but it was definitely a motel, not a hotel, nothing too luxurious. Just a place to stay right there on the ocean. In later years, we switched to the Crusader Motel. Wildwood Crest was teeming with people from North Jersey and Philadelphia who'd come to have an old-fashioned good time on the beach. They wanted to play ball, get a nice bite to eat on the Wildwood Boardwalk, which was home to some amazing cheesesteak restaurants, or nearby Seaside Heights, which also had great places for cheesesteak. Where you got your cheesesteaks was always a source of debate. In Seaside, there was Steaks Unlimited and Midway, which was a walk-up joint that used synthetic welfare-style cheese. That might sound disgusting, but let me tell you, when you're drunk, 5 Midway cheesesteaks are just about the best thing in the world. That welfare cheese goes down real easy. While we're on the subject, though, JR's Cheesesteak and Steaks Unlimited are my favorites, and on the Wildwood Crest Boardwalk, I prefer to places that use real cheese. Some even use mozzarella, which I have found to improve just about anything. By the summer of 1969, my parents' favorite band, the Four Seasons, had hit a bit of a dry patch after a tremendous run of 6 or 7 years of hits. That creative lull happens to everyone at some point, but this was worse, because the music of the time was changing too, and they weren't winning any new fans. Like so many groups of that era, they were forced to play much smaller venues. The week we happened to be in Wildwood, they were playing a 5-night engagement at the Starlight Ballroom, which was a decent-sized venue, but nothing worth writing home about. My mother and father really wanted to go see them, but they had no idea what they'd do with me for those few hours, so they kind of put it out of their minds. Or at least my mother did. My old man was not the type to be discouraged by anything. One afternoon, as they were passing the front desk at the motel, they asked the clerk how to get to the Starlight because they'd heard Frankie Valli was playing. There are certain people in this world who somehow earn the trust of strangers without even trying, because of the way they, you know, carry themselves. My father was one of them. "I'll give you a little hint," the clerk said, leaning forward. "Frankie Valli is actually staying right here in the motel." "Really?" my mother said, smiling. "What do you know?" my father said. There are also certain people in this world who know how to capitalize on a situation regardless of odds or etiquette. My father was one of them, too. Being a natural, smooth talker, Pop was able to get the room number out of the guy. My father was charming enough that all he probably did was slip the guy a sawbuck. For all you pussies who don't know what a sawbuck is, it's a $10 bill. We went up to the floor and passed by the room, but didn't see any action. The next day, we went back, and sure enough, as my father's crazy luck would go, Frankie Valli's door was ajar. My parents debated about what to do, knock and introduce themselves as fans, or just wander in like they didn't know he was there, pretending they were looking for someone else. Neither idea made sense to my father. He had a better one. "Okay, here's what we're gonna do," he told my mom. "That door is open just enough for little Artie to crawl through. Let's pretend he got away from us while we were walking down the hall, and he just went in there." "Absolutely not," my mother half shouted. "No, Artie, that is just crazy. What's he gonna say? It's a kid coming in his room. That way we don't look like two nuts camping outside of his room waiting to jump him or something. It'll break the ice. We are talking about a baby. How are you gonna tell him to do that?" "No, we are not doing that," my mom said. "Oh yeah, watch this." My father took one of my favorite toys and over the sound of my mother's protest threw it inside Frankie Valli's room. "Oh, Jesus, what have you done, Artie?" my mom said, shaking her head. My father knew that I went just about anywhere that toy went, and sure enough, I crawled right in there after it. Then they sat there, out in the hall, waiting for something to happen. "So what now?" my mother asked. "Shh," my father said. "He's gonna come out here in a minute holding the baby, and he's gonna look around and ask whose kid he is. And then we're gonna meet him. We'll get an autograph or maybe a picture, and that's it, okay?" Well, that didn't happen. 5 minutes went by, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. My mother, as any mother would, started to get really worried. My father kept reassuring her with statements like, "What, you think Frankie Valli is actually a kidnapper now and he's gonna do something crazy with him?" "Who knows," she said. "You don't. That's how my mother would deal with him. She'd remind him that his version of a situation wasn't the only possible scenario, and then follow up with about 52 completely logical alternatives. Typically, my father would have absolutely no answer for these. In this case, she had plenty to work with. "What if he was in a room with a girl? There could be naked people in there. He is a star. You have no idea what those people do in their hotel rooms. There could be some shady character in there dividing up money. He could be on drugs. A million different illegal things could be happening in there. Artie, you don't know." At these times, my father would listen, usually rolling his eyes for as long as he could stand it. Then he'd do something about it. In this case, he walked over to the door and pushed it open. He and my mother walked in slowly and didn't see anything close to the Sodom and Gomorrah my mother had imagined. At first, they didn't see anything at all. Then they looked toward the bathroom where the light was on and the door was open. And there I was, sitting on the sink in Frankie Valli's bathroom, playing with my toy with a big smile on my face. Next to me, in a robe, shaving, was Frankie Valli. He was amusing me with a blob of shaving cream. "Okay, little man," he was saying, "we're gonna find your parents right after I'm done shaving, but I hope they're not far, because I'm in a hurry, kid. As someone who's become a bit of a celebrity, if this were to happen to me, I would have called the FBI. But there was Frankie Valli, in his room, in a robe, shaving, when a toddler crawled in unannounced. And then the kid's parents show up. I'm much too suspicious. That would be too much for me. But this was a different time, and my father had that crazy Nork mentality that Frankie Valli definitely recognized and I'm sure could relate to. I've made my mom tell this story so many times that I have to believe her when she swears that, as insane as it sounds, it was not an awkward moment. "Oh, we're really sorry," my father said. "We were looking all over for him. Thank you so much for taking care of him. We are really sorry he crawled in here." Frankie, from the beginning, was completely cordial, and they started talking like it was no big deal that they were in his hotel room under the strangest possible pretenses. At some point in the conversation, my mother and father admitted that they were big fans. "You know what?" Frankie said. "You want to come to one of the shows?" "We'd love to," my mother said. "We just can't find a babysitter for our son." "Well, don't worry about that," Frankie said. "Bring him. We'll leave him backstage with some of the girls we have on tour. He'll be completely safe, I promise you. Just bring him along and you'll come with us. Why don't you get everything you need and we'll go down to the show in a few minutes." Just like that, my parents went from wondering if they'd even be able to get tickets to meeting Frankie in his room to attending the show as Frankie's guests. And it wasn't just for that night. Frankie invited them down to 2 or 3 shows. He saw that they were a young couple, in love, but struggling with money, and he was very, very generous with them. One of the nights after the show, he asked them to come out to dinner with him, the Four Seasons, and everyone else on the tour. And since they were all just people from Newark, my parents fit in just fine. Even though Frankie Valli and the band were hitting some hard times, they weren't anything less than gracious and humble. At some point, my parents and I were hanging out with Frankie and his crew on the terrace at the motel. My father had bought a camera for my mom in the motel lobby, and she took a bunch of pictures. She got me, my father, and Frankie Valli, as well as a few of me alone with Frankie, and then my dad took a few of my mom and Frankie. Actually, my parents took pictures in every conceivable configuration of themselves, me, and Frankie Valli. Most of them were lost in the shuffle over the years, but for most of my childhood, the best ones were proudly displayed in our house in Union in one of those square plastic picture cubes. Talk about status symbols. Displaying a big plastic cube full of pictures of Frankie Valli in your home in North Jersey was like driving through the ghetto in a brand new Bentley. People would come over and pick up the thing and say, "Wow, how do you know Frankie Valli?" "We're friends with him," my father would proudly say. "We were on vacation together there, down the shore." The truth was, after that week, my parents completely lost touch with Frankie Valli and never saw him again. I asked my mother if they got Frankie's contact information and tried to see him again, but she said no. She talked my dad into just being happy with the time they had with Frankie there that week. She didn't want to stay in touch and bug him, which in modern terms we call stalking. My mother also wouldn't ever have wanted Frankie to think they were taking advantage of his generosity. They might not have spent time with him again, but they continued to watch Frankie's career closely and remained big fans and supporters. When Jersey Boys opened on Broadway and Frankie was back in the news, I mentioned to Howard how I'd met him as a toddler and had my mom dig out the one remaining picture we still have with him. It was up on the Stern website for a while, and now here it is, forever in print. I've stared at this picture so many times over the years because it shows my father in his heyday. He's 24 or 25 years old. He looked like a movie star back then, my old man. He's in great shape from climbing roofs, and there I am sitting on his knee, blonde hair, dressed in all my little baby rebelia. And there's Frankie Valli, looking at me, smiling, trying to make me laugh. I get so unbelievably emotional when I look at this that sometimes I just start to cry. That moment captures so much. It's my family, it's my father, and it's Frankie Valli, a New Jersey hero who was to my father what Bruce Springsteen is to me. I'm there with my hero meeting his hero. It's hard for me to see myself as just a cute little kid, unaffected by life, without a care in the world. I had no idea then what I would later do to myself and my body as an adult. When Jersey Boys opened in 2005, it became an instant success, taking in something like 400 grand in ticket sales in just one day. It's still packing houses on Broadway, and it's gone on to be a huge national touring production as well. As soon as I heard about it, I immediately got tickets to take my mother to see it for her birthday. Four of us went. My mother, my beloved godmother, Aunt Dee, who was my mom's younger sister, Diane, my sister, Stacy, and me. I've seen it two more times since, and I assure you, it must be good for me to be recommending it here in my book. Did you think when you picked up this book that Artie Lang would be giving you tips on great Broadway musicals? Really, if you get a chance, see fucking Jersey Boys when you're in town, because it is the most fun you will ever have, whether you like the music or not. All of that attention a few years ago put Frankie Valli back in the public eye again. He was on a few talk shows. He got a small role on The Sopranos, and he released an album covering love songs from the 60s. This was around 2006 to 2007, when The Stern Show was making the move over to satellite radio. One day, Gary Delabate, the show's producer, came in and said to Howard during a break, "Would you like to have Frankie Valli in as a guest? We just had Paul Anka on, who had delivered in such an amazing way. He really was one of the best guests we'd ever had." Howard did one of his classic brilliant interviews, and Anka told great stories about Sinatra and the old days. People at the show had been on the fence about having him, but Anka blew other guests away. So when Frankie Valli came up, I stepped in. "Oh man, that'd be great," I said. "Look, you know, I got this great story about meeting him as a baby, and I could bring in the picture of me and him and see if it jars anything in his memory at all when we do the interview. Would it be all right if I had my mom up here to say hi to him in the green room after? She literally has not seen or talked to him in person since this week that she and my father and I spent with the Four Seasons at this motel in the summer of 69. Howard, as anyone who's met him or heard him in action knows, is always thinking. That guy's mind is just incredibly quick. "That would be great to do on the air if your mother agrees to it," he said. "Let's do it." I called my mom that afternoon, all excited to make this reunion happen. Now, my mother really hates being on camera and hates attention. In that way and so many other ways, she's the complete opposite of me. It took some time and a lot of badgering, but eventually I convinced her to come up to the show that day and see what would happen. Then, of course, some shit luck went on, and for whatever reason, Gary wasn't able to book Frankie. Then Frankie's character on The Sopranos got whacked, so he wasn't in the public eye anymore. But the musical is still going strong, and I'm still holding out, hoping that one day Frankie Valli will come up and do The Stern Show, and I'll be able to reunite him with my mom. It's sappy, and odds are that he doesn't remember a thing, but it would mean a lot to her and to me and to the memory of my dad to be able to stand there with him and show him that picture. It would be a special memory coming full circle. In my life, things like that are what I live for and what I look forward to. In the meantime, I've always got the musical. Mr. October. As a child, as far as I was concerned, my dad had an amazing job, and we had all the money we needed. My life was so fun and carefree that I never realized that we weren't rich, until I met someone rich. Still, I've never met a rich kid who grew up as happy as I did. When I started going to New York City to do comedy, and later on when I moved to L.A. to do Mad TV, I met plenty of people who grew up wealthy. These people came from families that had several homes, a staff of servants, and took vacations in beautiful, exotic locations all around the world. My family had one house, and my sister Stacy and I had a maid. We called her Ma. When we vacationed, there wasn't much of a debate between Fiji and Bora Bora. We relaxed strictly at the Jersey Shore. When I encountered rich people for the first time, I discovered that not only do they holiday in places that are hard to find on a map, they also use the names of the seasons as verbs. When they asked me, "Where did you summer and winter growing up?" I would usually say, "As a child, the same place I springed and autumned." Rich people know how to relax. That's all they do growing up, relax. I wish my mother knew how to relax, because now I have the money to let her take it easy. I wish she liked tennis or golf. Maybe skiing or world travel. Unfortunately, she doesn't. My mother likes cleaning tables with Pledge. If I'm ever blessed with a child, I'm going to encourage that child to take it slow. I'd like to see someone in my family fucking relax, even if it's 30 years from now. As I mentioned earlier, our family's favorite destination down the shore was Wildwood Crest, New Jersey. We'd head out there for the last 2 weeks of every summer and check into the Crusader Motel. And sure, it was only a motel, but it was right on the beach. While my mother and sister sat on the sand, my father and I would play baseball for what seemed like all day. As a kid, I was obsessed with baseball, and not much has changed since then. Like a lot of fathers and sons, my dad and I bonded over baseball more than anything else. Since my father spent his days climbing roofs and installing antennas, he was in great shape, which made it easier for him to keep up with an 11-year-old boy out on the baseball field all day long. We would start out playing catch, then he'd hit me grounders. After that, he'd usually follow up by hitting screaming line drives for me to chase down and that sort of stuff. Eventually, he'd work up to what he'd call the scorchers, which were shots he'd just slam into the field as hard as he could. Then he would pitch me batting practice for about an hour. He was the coolest ever, my old man. I'd hit balls all over the field, and he would go shag them down. Finally, if you can believe it, he'd come back in from the outfield and hit me fly balls, which he'd call skyers, for another hour or so. My father was a really good athlete, so his pop-ups really were sky high. Eventually, I learned how to judge them properly and catch them well. It was great training for when I started to play on teams, which I did all through school. My dad and I were constantly in search of a perfect surface where we could get good hops. A lot of the time we would end up on private golf courses where he'd hit me grounders on one of the greens. That was hilarious. Let me tell you, the hops we'd get on these well-groomed putting greens were amazing, but it was definitely challenging, mostly because I was in charge of watching out for cops coming to arrest us. My father was a real inner-city guy, so he had no concept that what we were doing was just so obviously wrong. He saw it as creating a slight inconvenience to the golfers. Before he'd start hitting me balls, he'd tell me to look out for, as he put it, the golf fags. I'd like to make my father laugh whenever I could, and during our practice I usually succeeded by doing play-by-play sports casting as I ran around catching fly balls. Playing baseball with him was great, but being able to make him laugh was the best. It put me on top of the world. Those moments were when I first realized the power you can have over people if you are able to make them laugh. If something pissed my father off, like usually me, I realized that I could get out of trouble if I could make him laugh when I fessed up to my crime. He'd always encourage me, too. Driving back from the ballpark in his truck with the ladder between us resting on the dash, he'd say, "Sport, if you don't make it in the majors, you'll probably have a career as a comedian." My dad's encouragement is definitely why those were the only two things I've ever wanted to do with my life. I never went through a period where I wanted to be a doctor, a cop, or even a rock star. All I wanted to do was play shortstop for the Yankees from the time I was about 5. Then I turned 15 and realized how silly that was and just gave up on it. And let's face it, that's the luckiest fucking break Derek Jeter ever got. The second my Yankees dream ended, though, the other one kicked right in, and once it did, I was really fucked. Historically, a successful life in comedy is a dream that's as pondered and unpursued as a career as an astronaut. For me, it became an obsession that consumed my life, as you will soon see. For now, though, I want to stick to baseball. So I'm about to share with you the very craziest experience I ever had with my dad. Clearly, my father was as much a best friend as he was a dad, and as you can probably tell by the golf course story, he had his own set of rules for everything. On October 18, 1977, my father took me to the final game of the World Series, the Yankees versus the Dodgers at Yankee Stadium. The Yankee team of the late 70s has got to be one of the coolest clubs in the history of sports. They had Willie Randolph, Reggie Jackson, Mickey Rivers, Lou Piniella, and, of course, my favorite, Thurman Munson. He was by far my favorite. The day Thurman died, August 2nd, 1979, I do not mind telling you, I wept. I was 11 years old, and it was devastating. If someone ever invents a time machine, my requested trip back in time is simple. I want to go back to 1977 and see any Yankees home game so that I can witness Munson hit a two-run double to right center field. I know what you're saying. How do you know he'll double in the game you're transported to? To me, this is a non-issue, because as a fan, I recall that Munson hit two-run doubles in every game that year just as easily as he showed up to play. I don't care what anybody says. 1977 was a magical year. The New York area was sweating through the hottest summer ever, and a midsummer blackout caused a lot of babies to be born in April of 1978. That year, the serial killer David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, terrorized the city. But every single thing that sucked that summer seemed to do nothing but make the Yankees better. The year before, they'd gotten to the World Series for the first time in 12 years. And when they did, they were swept four games straight by the fucking asshole Cincinnati Reds. Munson hit 529 in that series, and that fact alone, in addition to the fact that Johnny Bench batted 531, made me want to drive to Cincinnati and punch everyone in the city in the fucking face. I took that shit seriously after that loss. I refused to even watch WKRP in Cincinnati, which is a perfectly acceptable show. The next season, in 77, after falling behind some, the Yanks came on strong in September and won the division. And then they won the pennant against George Brett and the jerk-off Royals to get themselves in the series again. And that time, they were playing against the Los Angeles Dodgers, another team that I could not fucking stand. The 77 Dodgers were nothing but clean-cut California dude players. Chumps like Steve Garvey. I hate him. He had a haircut like a Marine for no good reason. He was always clean-shaven and well-groomed. Steve Garvey and the fucking L.A. Dodgers were the anti-Munson, so I could not wait to see the Yanks kick their asses in the series. That is how I felt, and how intensely I felt it back then at 9 years old. Sure, it was juvenile and the kind of reasoning that only a kid can have, but please believe me when I assure you that nothing at all has changed. In 1977, my father was 34 years old. He worked long, hard hours to pay the mortgage and support his wife and two kids. But regardless of whatever stress was going on for him, he was always capable of acting enough like a kid when he was with me that I never knew about it. He was always ready to play no matter how tired he was, and he was always planning something special. But his scheme that October took the cake. After the Yankees beat everyone and got into the World Series, my father told me he had a surprise for me. This was right around my birthday, October 11th, so I figured it could have been anything. A new glove, a new bat. But it was much, much better than that. That day, my father walked up to me and pulled the impossible out of his back pocket. Tickets to the series. The holy grail for any boy in the tri-state area. He had two tickets to every Yankees home game in the World Series that year. My dad was so far from a high roller his entire life, there was no way he'd won these tickets in a card game or scalped them from some exclusive ticket broker. In the middle of the year, he had sent away in the mail for them just in case the Yankees made it to the series again. He'd paid $10 a piece for them, and fittingly, they were in the very last row of the very last section of the very upper deck, right above third base. Those seats were sky high, literally hovering above the South Bronx. But even if we saw nothing, it still meant that we were going to be inside the fucking stadium for the World Goddamn Series of 1977. The Yankees versus the Dodgers. My dad would come home from work early every night we had tickets for the games, and he and I would get ready together. I was unbelievably excited. We lived in Union, New Jersey, which is a working-class suburb a few miles west of Newark. Without traffic, we could make it to Yankee Stadium in about half an hour. With traffic, it might take 2 days. My father hated public transportation, so he insisted on driving to the stadium. For an 8 p.m. start, we had to leave at 6 p.m. because we weren't going to miss anything. My father hated the thought of ever taking a bus or a train to get anywhere, probably as a result of the fact that he was what some people call nigger rich. No offense to African Americans or anything, that's just how I've heard the phrase used. Whatever you want to call it, the message was clear. My father was the kind of guy who never saved a dime. He behaved like a rapper who'd just gotten signed. He'd spend all of his cash on Cadillacs that he'd trade in every 2 years. Where my father was from, having the newest caddy was a huge status symbol. So, naturally, he liked to drive his car everywhere. On October 18th, 1977, his caddy du jour was a 76 Coupe de Ville. He worshipped that car. On top of all the other crazy shit that was going on in New York City in the late 70s, the city itself was broke. Entire neighborhoods looked like abandoned war zones. And the part of town that was the shining example of this problem, the one hit the worst of all, was the South Bronx. The blocks around the stadium were nothing but crumbling brick apartment houses with no residents. There were vacant lots full of cinder blocks and rubble everywhere. The area was full of drugs and drug addicts, and it seemed like heroin was slowly killing everything. But right in the middle of this pile of shit was the most famous address in the world of sports. 161 River Avenue, Yankee Stadium. All of this native scenery made it a very difficult job to park the Coupe de Ville. No spot ever seemed to be safe enough or big enough. But there was no question about doing it any other way, because my dad thought parking garages were a huge ripoff, and he was right. It was as true then as it is now. Over the years, I've gotten some psychotherapy, mostly because I was ordered to do so by either the court or my job. After sharing just a few stories about me and my family during those visits, I figured out pretty quickly that my father was definitely obsessive-compulsive. It wasn't a commonly known affliction back then, but in retrospect, it's clear to me that he had it bad. A prime example, for a guy who loved cash and having it on him and around him all the time, he was completely grossed out by it. He considered all money to be filled with germs that could spread sickness. After he showered and got ready for a night out, my dad could not and would not touch money. Either my mother dealt with the money for the night or he wore gloves. Always a brand new pair of the work gloves he'd wear to install the antennas. It was crazy. If he and my mom went out with other people, they'd be all dressed up for a social experience. And there he'd be with his hands, covered in sparkling clean new work gloves. I remember him wearing a pair like that each night we went to the series. He wore them to pay the tolls, of course. He even planned on how to further avoid touching money in spite of the gloves. Before we left, he had me line up quarters on the dashboard. When we got to the George Washington Bridge, all he had to do was reach over with his gloves on and grab them to pay the toll instead of fidgeting with his wallet. He would put a few extra quarters up there, too, for the guys who squeegeed your windshield when you got off the Jerome Avenue exit in the Bronx. The exit that everyone going to the game had to take. When the kids asked for it, he just lowered the window and pointed to the quarters and let them reach in and grab the money themselves. Looking back, if one of those kids had a knife or any kind of weapon, they could have done serious damage. But stuff like that didn't concern my father. He was more inner city and ghetto than anyone in the Bronx. He grew up in Newark. When it came to matters of the city street, he was always in control. He made you feel comfortable. If he was around, no one could hurt us. I still felt that way even after his injury. Even with him lying there, paralyzed from the neck down, he gave me a feeling of security. If someone broke into the house while he was hurt, I thought he would somehow still be able to protect us. He was my hero, always capable in my eyes. In any case, each of the games went like this. After we encountered the squeegee gangs and had driven around for what seemed like hours until my father found the one fucking parking spot in the South Bronx where it was impossible to get a door ding, we'd walk to the stadium. And we always made it in time to watch some batting practice. I remember that before game one, we saw Bucky Dent take his warm-up. He would become the World Series MVP in 1978 when the Yanks beat the Dodgers. We sat down about five rows behind third base, and I remember my father marveling at how close to the field we were and how expensive those seats must be. Ironically, we were sitting exactly where my season tickets are now located. I got there permanently, Pop. I know that he would love knowing that his son has those seats now. Also that first night, Bucky turned on one and hit a scorching line drive into the stands that hit a guy three rows in front of us right in the head. This man was probably about 50 years old and he was bald, and I can still recall just how scary the sound was when the ball hit him smack in his temple. It was like a soft piece of wood cracking in two. The guy went unconscious immediately, and my father helped the cops get him out of there. Stuff was getting crazy. I could not stop looking around at everything. The field, the players, all the action in the outfield. My father could tell that I was loving it. His son was as big a baseball fan as he was, and that made him ecstatic. To him, it also meant I probably wasn't gay. Talk about a perfect son. The World Series that year was phenomenal. In the first game, we watched Paul Blair win it for the Yankees with an extra inning single between short and third that drove Randolph home. The place went nuts. We were in baseball heaven. Even though our seats were geographically as far away from home plate as you could get, which technically was closer to heaven than home plate, it didn't matter. In the 70s, the upper deck at Yankee Stadium had its own charm. That first game was the first time that I ever smelled weed, and it worked on me a little too well, because the contact high I got cost my father at least $30 in hot dogs and pretzels. When I've told this story before, most publicly on Letterman, I recalled how my father made me hold his beer while he rolled a joint. I'm embarrassed to admit it now, but I lied to Dave. The truth is, my father never touched drugs and barely drank, but the guy in front of me sure as hell did both. And he asked me to hold his burning joint by the roach clip while he put mustard on a hot dog. My dad looked on and smiled and didn't care at all. He loved crazy people. Besides, what's more American than baseball, hot dogs, and weed? Especially all at the same time. The Yanks and the Dodgers split the first two games, and then the Yankees took 2 out of 3 in L.A., which brought it back to New York for Game 6, with the Bronx Bombers up 3-2. They had the chance to take it all in that sixth game. As a fan, part of me was upset that we didn't finish them off in L.A. on their own turf, but in a bigger way, I was thrilled to have the chance to see another game, possibly the final game, at home. If they took it, it would be their first World Series win in 15 years. So there we were, on October 18th, 1977, ready to go with the quarters on the dash, and my father in a brand new set of work gloves as we drove the Coupe de Ville once again into the Bronx. We dealt with the squeegee kids, found the best anti-door ding parking spot, got in early to have a couple of hot dogs and watch batting practice, and then we settled into our nosebleed seats to watch what would become the history-making Game 6 of the 1977 World Series. The great and controversial Reggie Jackson had already hit 2 home runs in the series, and he seemed primed to do something big that night. Because if there was one thing about number 44, he did not disappoint. His first time up at bat, Reggie walked. It seemed like the Dodgers wanted no part of him. They should have made way better sure of that, because the rest of the game belonged to the man Thurman Munson called Mr. October. Reggie's next 2 times at bat, he hit home runs, both of them screaming line drives into the stands behind Yankee Stadium's famously short right field fence. By the time he got up for his 4th at bat, the whole place could smell victory. The Yankees had the lead, and as Reggie Jackson stepped to the plate, we Yankee fans, who can never get enough excitement, were not only rooting for a win, we wanted a 3rd Reggie Jackson home run. My father and I were on our feet chanting, one more time, and Reggie, Reggie, Reggie. Everyone else there was doing the same thing. It was pandemonium. My father put me on his shoulders so I could see better, and Mr. Roachclip looked back at us and said, "Man, can you imagine what's going to happen if he hits another one? We will fucking tear this place down." Mr. Stoner's sentiment was cool and all, but thank God he was proven wrong on the destruction end of things. On the first pitch from Dodgers relief pitcher Bob Welch, Reggie unloaded that classic swing and hit a picture-perfect sky-high home run to dead center field. From the moment it left the bat, there was never a doubt where that ball was going. It touched down in the section of Yankee Stadium behind the center field fence, the batter's eye, where the fence is at its very farthest point from home plate. It's something that's hardly ever done. I think Reggie was only the 2nd player ever to have done so in the history of the park, the first being the Orioles' designated hitter and current Yankees announcer Ken Singleton. We might not have torn the place down, but it nearly collapsed all on its own. As soon as that ball left the park, the entire crowd started jumping up and down and screaming. You could feel the upper deck shaking as if there were an earthquake. It was actually pretty scary, but none of that mattered. I was 10 years old, sitting on my father's shoulders at Yankee Stadium, after watching Reggie Jackson round the base for the 3rd straight time that night. I was in baseball little boy heaven, 3 homers on 3 consecutive pitches. If I could somehow capture a fraction of that happiness again now, I would not be up at 3 a.m. on a work night writing this story with a tall glass of whiskey keeping me company. With the ninth inning upon us, the Yanks were up 8-4 and just 3 outs away from their 21st series title. To commemorate that moment, my father saw the opportunity to do something that was so unbelievably and uniquely him that to hear the retelling is almost, but not quite, as good as shaking his hand. My father was crazy, but in a wonderful and loving way. Yet still, what he had in mind, if a social worker or a cop had overheard his plan, would have no doubt ended up with him being thrown in jail. But it was this kind of thing that defined who my father was. And lucky for him, this was New York in the crazy 70s, which was a time before the country had agreed to collectively stick an uptight ruler up its ass. Just being in the stadium for the last out was not enough for Artie Lang Sr. What he really wanted was to see the end of the game from the front row. My father was a master at conning people and sneaking into places he was not allowed, so this did not seem at all out of the question. Combined with the fact that back then, security was nowhere near as stiff at baseball games as it is now, it wasn't very tough for anyone to bullshit or tip a guard to get up front. It was no effort at all for my dad, so before I knew it, we had snuck and weaved our way up to the first row. Just left off the Yankees dugout, with just 1 out left. It was nothing short of amazing to be right there, with all the crowd's energy and excitement all around us. You'd think that would be cool enough. Not for my old man. He wanted more. As Lee Lacy, the player who would end up making the last out for the Dodgers, stepped up to the plate, my father turned to me with this intense look on his face. "Now listen, when the game ends, I will not be able to get on the field," he said. "But you can." "I can," I said. "Really?" I looked at the field and saw a bunch of New York City cops lined up with their billy clubs out, just waiting to smack the shit out of anybody who tried to run onto the field. "Listen," my father continued, "when the last out is made, I'm going to throw you onto the field." "Okay," I said, looking up at him, thinking that, since my dad was suggesting it, this plan was absolutely fine. "Okay, yeah. Now, when you get on the field, I want you to run to shortstop and just wait for me there," he said, looking me in the eye. "The cops will not hit a kid. They never hit kids, so you've got nothing to worry about. Eventually, I'll be able to get out there on the field, and when I do, I will meet you at shortstop, okay?" I nodded my head. "I got it," I said. "Remember," he said, pointing at the field, "shortstop." There were 2 outs when, on the last pitch of the game, Lacy squared to bunt and popped it up right to Yankees pitcher Mike Torres. Torres caught the ball easily to end the game, and he and Thurman Munson embraced at the mound and started the celebration. When I saw that they'd won, I practically went numb. I started screaming and jumping up and down uncontrollably. It was such an overwhelming feeling of elation that I was incapable of containing myself in any way. To this day, I have never been as happy as I was at that moment. I think that deep down, subconsciously, I've been chasing that feeling ever since. That type of rush, the kind that overcomes every bit of your being, is the same rush you get when you first chase money and gamble. And heroin, don't even get me started. I've done both of those over and over again, and even at their best, they didn't measure up to a fraction of what I felt that night. I think most people's happiest times occur when they're children. Whether you're rich or poor, we're all kids for a while. It's an experience we all share. From 6 to 15, nothing means shit, no matter how you grow up. We are basically carefree. That's why the most despicable crime in the world is for an adult to abuse a child, mentally or physically. Aside from the obvious wrong in that, anyone who does something inappropriate to a child also robs them of something they can never get back. The only time in life when anyone can ever be 100% happy. Not to sound like a negative prick, but once you become an adult, particularly if you do not have money, life becomes just one stressful, unending parade of depressing bullshit. I didn't put all of that together as a 10-year-old. I was too busy losing my mind with joy. My heart was racing, and the fucking night just kept getting crazier. For a second, I thought my father forgot about his plan to storm the field. I thought I was off the hook. No such luck. As I lost myself in celebrating, I felt my father's hand on my lower back. He yelled in my ear, "I'll meet you at short." He threw me up over the line of cops and out onto the field as naturally as if he was shooting a free throw. I somersaulted onto the on-deck circle and looked back at my father. There he was, grinning ear to ear as he pointed at me and yelled, "Run to short!" I turned around and booked as hard as I could to shortstop and saw firsthand that my dad was right about the cops. They didn't bother me at all, but all around me they were taking down anyone who looked like they might be a member of Led Zeppelin. No, it was worse than that. They were hitting any adult male on the field as hard as they could with their nightsticks. It was a fucking war zone. Right next to me, some guy stole Willie Randolph's hat right off his head. I saw Reggie barreling into people like Earl Campbell running into linebackers. I was confused, scared, and 10 years old. I felt like Willem Dafoe at the end of Platoon when the chopper takes off, leaving him to get shot to death. I wanted to drop to my knees in slow motion and raise my hands to heaven just like Dafoe. But I didn't do that. Somehow I kept running. I made it to shortstop and waited there just like my father said. It was really freaky, especially to a kid. I kept staring at this fat guy who'd been knocked out and was lying on the ground by third base with blood coming out of his head. After about 15 minutes, I was ready to start crying. The only thing that stopped me was the knowledge that my father was Superman and he would be showing up to handle the situation any minute now. Then I felt a tap on my shoulder. I turned around and there he was. Just like Reggie, my father did not let me down. "We won," he yelled. He was beaming just as big as I ever saw him. Then he put me back on his shoulders and the tears that were seeping from my eyes immediately turned to tears of joy. After that, we walked around the field until they turned the lights off and kicked us out. But before we left, my father told me to run into the Yankees dugout and sneak a quick drink from the water fountain. Then, like so many others, we dug up a patch of the infield grass to take with us. When we finally got home sometime around 3 a.m., my father, being a good parent, laid down the law. "Forget about going to school tomorrow," he said. "I don't care what your mother says." He was definitely in best friend mode at that point. Instead of going to school, I spent the day with him, and we planted the Yankee Stadium grass in our front yard. Our family is long gone from that house, but that patch of history is probably still part of the lawn at 433 Huntington Road in Union, New Jersey. That night was the pinnacle of my childhood, and I am so thankful to have shared that moment with my father. Exactly 8 years later, on October 18th, 1985, my childhood and the carefree part of my life officially ended. On the 8th anniversary of that day, my father fell off a roof while installing an antenna and became a quadriplegic for the rest of his life. It happened 1 week after my 18th birthday. A week after my 10th birthday, we'd celebrated Reggie's 3 World Series home runs together. 1 week after my 18th birthday, I watched him spin around on a special bed with a metal halo screwed into his head to prevent further damage to his spine. Happy days for my family and me were over for a long, long time. My father remained alive and suffering for 4.5 years after the accident, before passing away from an infection caused by a bad bed sore and complications from diabetes. He'd been diagnosed with diabetes when he was 25 and had administered himself a shot of insulin every day since. Though it ultimately played a role in his death, it never slowed him down in his life. My father died on February 1st, 1990, at age 46, and those 4.5 years between his accident and his death were nothing less than a living hell. Not a moment went by when I didn't feel crippling guilt for not being there with him, holding the ladder that day. I used to work with my dad a lot as soon as I was old enough, and holding the ladder was usually my job. It ate me up that if I'd gone to work with him that day, it never would have happened. On the morning of October 18th, 1985, I wasn't with my dad because I did something unique, for me at least. I went to college. Even though I had to go to summer school to graduate from Union High, I was able to gain admission to Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey. It had nothing to do with my non-existent academic prowess. My Uncle Frankie supposedly knew someone in the admissions office. That's how I got in. And in that, it was typical. With my family, there's always a scam. I went to college for exactly 4 weeks, and the only grade I can speak of is an A that I received for an oral presentation I made in one class. I forget what the assignment was exactly, but I was the subject of my presentation. I did what I've done in front of people ever since. I told stories about my family and about my life. It was the first time I got a bunch of laughs in front of a crowd of total strangers, and it felt amazing to get that reaction from people. It's a power trip that you never get over. I also tried out for the baseball team, which didn't work out so well. Seton Hall has a great sports program, and trying to join without a scholarship is pretty rough. But I did my best, and even though nothing came of it, I realized how much I loved playing ball. During my one-month college career, I also realized just how much I hated school. It bored me to death. The only highlight was that one day I got laughs in front of my class, and in the long run, it was the only education that I really needed. That experience convinced me that I could be a comedian, and just as soon as it happened, I began to think up ways that I could quit college. I definitely couldn't just leave. I needed some kind of excuse, since my uncle basically got me in. And then fate handed me the perfect one, which I wish it never had. Namely, helping my family deal with the tragedy of my father's accident. That horrible Friday, I daydreamed through my classes as usual, had lunch with some friends, and then drove home at about 1:30 p.m. When I walked through the door, I was greeted by the sight of my mother sitting in the kitchen crying. "Mom," I said, "what is it? What happened?" "Daddy had an accident," she said through her sobs. "He fell off a roof." I could tell by how hard she was crying that everything was not okay. "Ma," I said, afraid to ask my question, "is he dead?" "No, Artie, he's alive, but it's not good," she said. "It's not good at all." My father was laid up at St. Barnabas, the same hospital in Livingston, New Jersey, where my sister and I had been born. I drove over there with my mother in the car I owned at the time, a fire engine red 1976 Buick Special that I would total precisely 8 days later. It was the last decent car that she or I would have for the next 10 years. October 18th, 1985 was the day of my dad's accident, and my very last day at Seton Hall. From that moment until his death, I dealt with my guilt by engaging in every single piece of shitty, self-destructive, self-pitying, wah-wah-wah type of behavior there is. Drinking, drugging, gambling, and bar fights that led to arrests became my everyday routine, and that was just what I did at night. My mother and sister, however, responded by being strong. No, very strong women. While our family struggled to maintain a shred of the kind of life we used to enjoy, my sister put herself through FIT in New York City by bartending. Her hard work and achievement helped my mother's mood greatly, because my mother did everything in her power to shield her children from this tragedy. But that was simply impossible. For those 4.5 years, not a day went by that my mother did not look completely exhausted. And each and every day, I hated that. But there was no escape. Medicaid provided my father with the minimum care they could, which meant that at night my mother had to set alarm clocks to go off every 2 hours so she could get up to turn my father in his bed. It was the only way to keep him from getting sores. My father was a well-built, heavy man, and she did it all by herself, every 2 fucking hours. That was her night, and her day was just as busy. It began at 6 a.m. when she woke up, made him breakfast, fed him, got him ready for the nurse, then showered, got dressed, and went off to work as a secretary. She'd come back home on her lunch hour to make sure that all was well and that the nurse was doing her job properly, then return to work for the afternoon. When she got off at 5 p.m., she'd come home. The nurse would leave, and my mother would make dinner for herself and my father. Then the evening cycle began again. Medicaid did not provide for care on the weekends, so for those 2 days, my mother was on duty for 48 hours straight. We weren't at all rich before, but now we were struggling on top of the strain of caring for my father and keeping our family afloat. My mother had to deal with the shitty cars that always broke down and asshole government workers, because if the welfare and Medicaid checks didn't keep coming, we would have lost the house. All the while, she kept up a brave facade, so my sister and I would never know just how bad it really was. Every single day, I felt like such a failure, so helpless. I was supposed to be the man of the family, and I was so far from doing what even the generous might call a passable job of it. After a relentless period of continuously fucking up, however, I got back on track and made making it in comedy my one and only obsession. It wasn't the promise of fame or of achieving a career or a purpose in life for myself. All I wanted to do was make enough money to buy my mother some relaxation and peace. That was the light at the end of the tunnel. That was the goal. That was how I kept the pressure on myself. It's amazing how time plays tricks on you. When you're a kid, a day seems to take a year, and a school year is an eternity. When you're an adult, when times are good, entire years go by in what feels like the space of one season. But the worst trick time plays on you is just how slowly the worst times in your life take you to live through. Those feel like one endless, horrible moment that just won't stop. The night before my father died, I had dinner with him, and we watched TV together in his room. After a while, I told him that I was going to my friend Mike Lawler's house to watch some college hoops. I made sure he was okay and said goodnight to him and started to leave. But as I got to the door, he did something he never did. He called me back. "Come on," he said, a genuine tone of sorrow in his voice. "Take a few more minutes and talk to your old man." I gladly sat back down, and we talked for a while longer. He had, from the moment he'd been injured, done the best he could to keep up his sense of humor, which wasn't easy under the circumstances. But tonight he was very sad, much more so than usual, and he didn't try to hide it. We talked a little, but for the most part, we sat there in silence together. I could tell that he didn't want to be alone. "Well," he said, trying to smile, "you'd better get going if you want to catch the game." As I got up to go, my father made one more request. "Put your hand on my hand, sport," he said. I held his hand and watched him struggle to bring my hand to his mouth to kiss it. "I love you, son," he said. He started to cry. "I love you too, Pop," I said, unable to hold back my own tears. We cried for a few minutes before we both got it together. Then I fixed his blankets and made him as comfortable as I could in preparation for a night's sleep, giving my mom a rare break. I said goodnight, went to the door, turned out the lights, and that was the last time I saw him alive. I went drinking over at my buddy's house, watched a couple of college basketball games I'd bet on, and after losing both bets, returned home drunk at about 4 a.m. On my way to my room, I looked quickly toward my father's room, and everything seemed calm and as normal as it could be. I went upstairs and fell asleep until 3 hours later at 7 a.m. I awoke to the sound of my mother and my Uncle Rich knocking hard on my bedroom door. I was not happy about that at all. "What?" I yelled. "What is it?" "Artie, there's an ambulance outside for your father," my uncle said. I opened the door, and standing next to Uncle Rich was my mother, crying. "He's gone, Artie," she said, sobbing. "He's gone." I ran downstairs to my father's room and found two paramedics and two police officers next to his bed. The police tried to stop me from coming into the room, but when I explained who I was, they let me approach. And there was my hero, the toughest motherfucker I would ever know, lying there, lifeless. He had died sometime in the middle of the night while I was at my friend's house doing shot after shot to help me deal with losing bets on two fucking college basketball games. 4.5 years of paralysis had turned my father's powerful muscular arms to jelly. His face looked fat and his stomach was distended like that of a starving African child in a UNICEF ad. I closed my eyes and started to cry as hard as I ever have. It wasn't just the shock of the loss. It was the way that he'd gone, much too soon, and so unlike the way he'd lived. I wasn't going to accept that. I wasn't going to let that become my father in my mind. I wasn't going to open my eyes until I remembered him the way he was when I first got to know him. I fought against my grief until I saw him again in the early 70s, with his hair long, his face young, walking with a strut in his step, like a typical guy from the streets of Newark who thought he was invincible. My dad was Superman to me, and in my mind he always will be, and that's all that counts. Even though my father was an atheist, in his final years he came to believe in God and at least tried to make peace with him. So I did what I thought was right and what I thought he'd want me to do. I made the sign of the cross, then I grabbed his hand. "I'll see you again someday, Pop," I said. "We'll play catch." I covered him with the bedsheet, and that was the last time I ever saw his face. My dad had asked us not to have a wake because of the condition the accident had left him in. We complied, and instead we had a mass in his honor at the Holy Spirit Church in Union, where, as it happened, I had raised hell as a CCD student 10 years before. My father was the type of guy who had amassed a lot of friends over the years, so the service was very crowded. I delivered the eulogy, and though it was hard to choose just one story to explain everything I wanted to say about my father, I chose to share the one that says it all to me. The night my dad and I went to Yankee Stadium and watched Reggie Jackson hit 3 homers to win the World Series. What happened to my father is nothing you can prepare for and nothing you can predict, but as life-changing and devastating as it was to all of us, it never robbed us of our memories. I've got thousands of them to keep me smiling through the tears, and if it ever gets really bad, I've got a pretty simple, always reliable solution. If I want to stop crying and start laughing, all I need to do is recall October 18th, 1977. My dad and Mr. October never disappoint. Union's Most Wanted. Flashing back to August of 1985, I can really appreciate now just how carefree and easy I had it. Little did I know that everything I took for granted would only last another 2 months. Why would I think I was anything but invincible when I was loving life that much? I was 17 years old and had just graduated from high school. Well, that's not exactly right. I had to go to summer school to get my diploma. But on August 7th, summer school let out and I was completely free. I had a job working a few hours a week at a restaurant called Beacon Hill, where I washed pots and pans. Every once in a while, to add to my financial portfolio, I worked construction at a job my Uncle Frank got for me, unloading sheetrock and insulation in the scorching sun. The future looked bright, man, especially from the driver's seat of my ride. At the time, I was rolling in my first car, which I'd bought the year before on my birthday. It was a blue 1974 AMC Matador with a 305-horsepower V8 engine, a radio that pumped, and ice-cold air conditioning. That car was so kick-ass that to this day it remains the best $600 I ever spent in my life, hookers included. The first 5 cars I bought in life I paid for in cash and then waited for change from the guy. I had a girlfriend at the time, too, a nice Italian girl from Union named Sue Picardi. We'd started going out that April and were kind of an item, enough to go to the prom together and everything. It was high school, so at first it was a casual relationship that I didn't take all that seriously. On prom night, as so many other Jersey kids do every single year to this day, my friends and I went down to Seaside Heights and checked into the Franklin Motel on Franklin Avenue. At some point that weekend, I have no idea exactly when, I fell completely in love with Sue. At least love is what I thought I fell in. Maybe what I did was fall out of my happy-go-lucky teenage daydream and into reality for a minute. Just long enough to realize that Sue was leaving town to attend college in South Jersey on the second-to-last day of August. From that moment on, I thought about her constantly and about how my time with her was running out. It also became clear to me pretty quick that Sue wasn't feeling the same kind of Romeo and Juliet devotion to our relationship that I had recently developed, but I wasn't going to let that stop me. Instead, it became my inspiration. After we got back from prom weekend, I tried to spend as much time with Sue as possible in an effort to make her fall as hopelessly in love with me as I now was with her. Keeping up our romance once Sue left for college would have been the tough, typically useless endeavor it is for so many kids that age. But of course, I was more than ready to give that a shot. But I was alone on that one, too. Because as the summer days sped by, Sue began to give me subtle signs that she wanted to break up before she left for school. She was a tough chick to read, and it was hard to understand what she really meant, especially when she said things like, "Artie, I want to break up before I leave for school." Whenever she brought it up, I told her that I understood and I kept appearances, but secretly I was devastated. I was determined to change her mind, so whenever we hung out together, I tried to impress her with stupid stunts, because to me that was the one skill I possessed that was going to make me more desirable in her eyes. Whenever I was in her presence that summer, I was constantly looking for opportunities to pull off some kind of wise-ass maneuver that would win her heart. One of the grander gestures I could only attempt at my friend Mike's place of employment. So visiting him soon became a thing to do. My friend Mike worked in the housewares department at the Bradley's department store in town, where one time he'd shown me how to get on the intercom to make a store-wide announcement. All you had to do was pick up a courtesy phone wherever you found one and dial 6. That was it. Some chime would go off, and then you were on the store's PA system. Security wasn't too tight back then on the Bradley's airwaves. Mike regretted sharing that little piece of employee know-how with me because I used it as often as possible, usually to get him in trouble, until he was eventually kicked out. For instance, once I stopped into the store with a few friends, picked up a courtesy phone, dialed 6, and cheerfully said, "Hello, shoppers, welcome to Bradley's. We'd like to announce a special promotion. For the next 30 minutes only, every item in our housewares department will be absolutely free." That's right, everything in housewares will be free for the next 30 minutes. Just stop by and ask for Mike. He'll be happy to help you. We all found that shit hilarious, but it's pretty safe to say that those pranks had a lot to do with Mike later needing to seek gainful employment elsewhere in Union's retail landscape. Anyway, one day in the summer of 85, I walked into the store with Sue, that very same Mike from Housewares, who, by the way, is also known as Shecky, and another friend of mine, Chico. To impress Sue, without a word, I walked over to a courtesy phone, dialed 6, and said, hello, Bradley shoppers. I'd like to announce that it's homosexual night here at the store. All fags get 10% off any purchase. That's right. Just walk up to the checkout, show us that you're a fruit, and we'll give you 10% off. It's our way of saying thank you to all the fruit shopping here at Bradley's tonight. That definitely got me big laughs from Sue and my friends, but it also got me caught red-handed by two plainclothes security guards. Sue watched as they hauled me off to their back office, ripping my Thurman Munson shirt in the process. I went from hilarious hero to total loser in the blink of an eye. Pulling off a prank is great, if you pull it off. There's probably nothing worse in the world of class clowning than getting busted in the act and humiliated by the very authority figures you made such a huge effort to ridicule. I didn't go to the big house. That came later on in my glorious life. The guards let me off with a warning, but they did make such a huge show of publicly scaring the shit out of me that I had to declare that grand plan of mine officially a failure.